Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. As we're coming up to the 10-year anniversary of the podcast next year in 2022, I'm looking at some things that I talked about basically 10 years ago, and trying to sort of reapproach them and talk about them in new ways. And so today I'm going to start off a series of podcasts. I might do actually another one later this week on the Battle of the Atlantic. The Battle of the Atlantic was Churchill said, or even apocryphally said, because Churchill quotations are so many, and so many things have been attributed to him. There's even a school an idea called Churchillian drift, where over time more and more things apparently said by Winston Churchill. But supposedly he said that the only thing that ever really, really made him afraid during the Second World War was the possibility of losing the Battle of the Atlantic, losing the ability for Great Britain to import food. Britain, since the mid-19th century, had been a net food importer. Britain's sort of transition from protection to free trade in the 1840s brought about the country being a net food importer, and Britain didn't have the wherewithal, didn't have the abilities in 1939 to completely sustain itself from its own domestic food supply. And so during the First World War, Germany was well aware that this was potentially how you defeat Great Britain. You can starve Britain out. It transpired that the Royal Naval blockade on Germany actually starved Germany into the point of insurrection and revolution in November 1918, plus huge battlefield losses after the Battle of Amiens. Anyway, the British knew that this would be the strategy again, that U-boats would sink food convoys coming from America and Canada, and that convoy protection would be one of the key parts of winning the war. So the Royal Navy is a huge and some often overlooked part of the British kind of contribution to Britain's national survival. You know, in British national memory, the almost kind of hallowed, the almost sort of civic religion that we've created out of the Second World War in Great Britain, as the country spirals towards ever greater levels of nostalgia and neuroticism. Think events such as Dunkirk, the Blitz and the Battle of Britain, and then D-Day stand out as being key moments where sort of Britain's soul in the war is forged. And the Battle of the Atlantic, because it was a longer process, it was less kind of identifiable as a moment. It tends to get overlooked. So we're looking at that standard tome, All Hell Let Loose by Max Hastings, which, as I've said before, you know, as a general reader on the Second World War, is pretty good. A better book, and one that maybe I'll dip into next year, is Anthony Beevor's History of the Second World War. But the two are fairly objective, and they don't suffer from the kind of the jingoistic fantasies that certain historians like to inject into their work. Okay, so Max Hastings writes, "The British Army's part in the struggle against Nazism was vastly smaller than that of the Russians, as would also be the US Army's contribution. Beyond Britain's symbolic role in holding aloft the standard of resistance to Hitler, from 1940 onwards, its principal strategic importance became that of a giant aircraft carrier and naval base, from which the bomber offensive and return to the continent were launched. It fell to the Royal Navy to conduct the critical struggles of 1940 to 43 to keep the British people fed, to hold open the sea lanes to the Empire and the overseas battlefields, and convoy munitions to Russia. Naval might could not bring about the defeat of Germany, nor even protect Britain's Eastern Empire from the Japanese. It was a fundamental problem for the two Western allies that they were sea powers seeking to defeat a great land power, which required a predominantly Russian solution. But if German efforts to interdict shipments to Britain were successful, Churchill's people would starve. A minimum of 23 million tons of supplies a year, half the pre-import total, had to be transported. The pre-war import total had to be transported across the Atlantic in the face of surface raiders and U-boats. Protecting this commerce was a huge endeavour. The Navy had suffered as severely as Britain's other services from interwar retrenchment. The construction of big ships required years, and even a small convoy escort took months to build. Britain's shipyards were indifferently managed and manned by an intransigent labour force, which began to work only a little harder when the Soviet Union was obliged to change sides, and communists of all nationalities endorsed the war effort. Britain built and repaired ships more slowly, if more cheaply, than the United States, and could never match the American capacity. For the Royal Navy, shortage of escorts was a pervasive reality of the early war years. I mean, if this makes sense of Churchill's deal with Roosevelt in the one of the Lend-Lease deals, the basis for destroyers, where 50 US destroyers were given to the Royal Navy in return for access to British bases, primarily in the Caribbean. When the destroyers turned up, they were actually of questionable value. They were old and not particularly good and not particularly fit for purpose. But they managed to kind of plug the gap that the British had made for themselves during the 1930s by the cancellation of orders and the mothballing of shipyards, the loss of shipyard workers during the Great Depression, men who were put on short hours, who wound up having to go and do other things, or who simply older workers who retired altogether. An example of the effect of austerity measures was that in 1931, pay cuts to the Royal Navy led to a mutiny at the naval base at Invergordon in Scotland. Anyway, the problem that the British had was that it was difficult to concentrate strength against enemy capital ships, which might be few in number, but which posed a threat and were deployed many hundreds of miles apart. In the first war years, writes Max Hastings, German surface raiders imposed as many difficulties as U-boats. They needed the need to divert convoys from danger zones increased the strain on British merchant shipping resources. The surface raiders that the British initially feared were capital ships such as the Tirpitz, the Graf Spee, the Prince Eugen, and the Bismarck, who were capable of attacking British convoys and devastating them. And Churchill put a lot of effort as First Lord of the Admiralty before he became Prime Minister into focusing on the problems of surface raider ships, not to any great success. The eventual sinking of the Bismarck was in part a strategic victory, but also a great propaganda victory to show that the Royal Navy could get the better of Hitler's surface fleet. And it was a kind of a gesture, as the British attempted to make several times over, to the Soviets to show that the British were doing their bit and were attacking the enemy where they could do. There was no opportunity to wage a land war at this point, other than in North Africa, which the Soviets rightly dismissed as something of a sideshow, as far as they were concerned. And the ability to fight a war at sea was of crucial importance. The need to divert convoys from danger zones increased the strain on the British merchant shipping resources. German sorties between 1939 and 1943 precipitated dramas which seized the attention of the world. The pocket battleship Graf Spee sank 9 merchantmen before being scuttled after its encounter with 3 British cruisers off the River Plate in December 1939. The 56,000-ton Bismarck destroyed the battlecruiser Hood before being somewhat clumsily dispatched by a converging British squadrons on the 27th of May 1941. The British public was outraged when the Scharnhorst and the Nassau made a dash for Wilhelmshaven from Brest through the Channel Narrows on the 21st to the 22nd of February 1942. Suffering only mine damage amid fumbling efforts by the Navy and the RAF to intercept them. The presence of the Tirpitz in the fjords of Norway menaced British Arctic convoys and strongly influenced home fleet deployments until 1944. where, on a biographical note, it was sunk by a squadron of Lancasters led by one Willie Tate, who, it transpired, went to a school that I taught at several years ago. We uncovered it in the school records and put a plaque to him outside. So there you go. Further afield, the Italian Navy had formidable numerical strength, and when the Japanese entered the war, the Royal Navy suffered severely at their hands, losing the Prince of Wales in the repulse off the coast of Malaya in 1942. So the Royal Navy in 1939 is a kind of a beast that is becoming quite out of date. It is past its prime. The lost decade of the 1930s has really, really been quite catastrophic for Britain's sea power. But of course, we're transitioning away from a time where the capital ship is the battleship. The next half century is going to be the age of the aircraft carrier. And in the Second World War is the last hurrah of Britain's Royal Navy. After the end of the Second World War, by the late 1940s, huge numbers of British warships are being left to rust. Max Hastings writes, most British battleships were old, slow, and could not be adapted for bulky modern fire control equipment. The Dutch Navy's triaxially stabled Hazemeyer system represented the most advanced AA gunnery technology in the world, to which the Royal Navy gained access in 1940. It was fragile and unreliable, however, and the British version entered general service only in 1945. Anti-aircraft fire control remains sadly ineffective, meanwhile. The British had more carriers than the US Navy in 1943, but they were never enough to go round, or rather to meet global demand. And they were too small to carry powerful air groups. Fleet air arm pilots displayed notable courage, but their performance was indifferent in both air combat and anti-shipping operations. The RAF, doctrinally committed to a strategic bomber offensive, resisted the diversion of resources to support operations at sea. Throughout the conflict, the Royal Navy displayed the highest standards of courage, commitment and seamanship, but until 1943, it struggled against odds to fulfil too many responsibilities with too few ships, all vulnerable to air attack, as the fate of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse showed. In the journey to the Far East, when the colonies of Malaya and Singapore were threatened, announced by Winston Churchill, as the Japanese knew that British ships were coming, they began to practice dive bombing tactics against capital ships. One of the problems that the British face in the Second World War is, of course, imperial overstretch. The problem that the British have is they have a predominantly Southeast Asian empire, a European enemy. They have a latterly an Asian enemy in Japan after December 1941, and they have a Mediterranean enemy that threatens to choke off the sea lane to the east. And so these three opponents, and there was the possibility that the Soviet Union might well have been a fourth opponent, the British were had all sorts of plans to fight the Soviet Union in 1939, meant that the British have a huge amount of overstretch, the Royal Navy being the kind of the medium by which the empire is held together. And the Mediterranean was one of the principal areas of Churchill's interest. Churchill was hugely concerned that the Allies and he at the Casablanca conference in early 1943 pressurised the Americans to take his view. And this is not the last moment, really, that Churchill had the upper hand in any conversations with Roosevelt, that the Mediterranean strategy came first. However, there is an impact on the Royal Navy. Churchill's decision to make major British military effort in North Africa obliged the Navy to conduct operations in the Mediterranean with negligible air cover and in the face of strong Axis air forces operating from fields in Italy, Sicily, Libya, Rhodes, Greece and Crete. Able seaman Charles Hutchinson described an air attack on the cruiser Carlisle in May 1941. The bombers came and attacked us wave after wave. They seemed to single out a ship and deliver a mass attack on it, diving vertically and from all angles. A huge bomb exploded in the water near our gun. Tons of water crashed down on us, tearing us away from the gun and tossing us around like straw. I was certain we would be swept over the side. One thought flashed in my mind. My God, this is the end. After what seemed like an eternity, we picked ourselves up, blew up our life belts and kicked away our shoes, as I for one expected to abandon ship. But in a short time, we were firing again, as we were still being attacked. Huge pieces of shrapnel lay around. There was a huge column of black smoke amidships and a direct hit on number two gun. There isn't a gun now, just a piece of charred metal. Nearly all the gun's crew were wiped out. Most of our lads trapped underneath the gun or blown against the splinter shield. It was a ghastly sight. We've lived and slept all as a family for a year and a half. Laughed, quarrelled, joked, all gone ashore together, discussed our private lives. Poor old Bob Sylvie is still under the gun. I've seen him, but it's impossible to get him out. So, following the disaster in Greece, where the British landed in order to force out Italy and to prevent a German seizure of Greece, the opposite happened. The British were forced out of Greece by a German advance. It was an evacuation to Crete. Crete is reinforced. Troops, particularly Australian troops, were taken from North Africa, just as the British are getting the upper hand in North Africa, and it's another one of Churchill's blunders, and reallocated to Crete, and then Crete falls when the airfields at Malimi, it was identified as a weak point, and German airlift came in, and Crete was lost. Losing Crete and much of the rest of the Mediterranean meant that Malta became a key point in the British lifeline to its forces in North Africa. And Max Hastings writes about Malta. Malta, the only offshore outpost in the central Mediterranean from which Axis supply routes to North Africa could be interdicted, faced 3 years of siege. Under almost continuous bombardment from nearby Sicily, at times, the island became unserviceable as an offensive base for submarines and surface ships, but it remained a vital earnest of Britain's will to fight. Hitler blundered by failing to seize Malta in 1941, and huge efforts and sacrifices were made to sustain it thereafter. Between June 1940 and early 1943, the Mediterranean was largely unusable as an Allied supply route. But Churchillian war-making emphasised assertion of the Navy's presence and engagements of opportunity, especially against the Italian fleet. Some of the fiercest naval fighting of the war and heavy British losses took place in those limpid waters. The Axis faced increasing pressure on its own sealings to North Africa, but the passage between southern Italy and Tripoli was short. Only in mid-1942 did shipping losses and fuel shortages begin to exert an important influence on Rommel's fortunes. And this is true, because by 1942, it was becoming clear to Germany, clear to Rommel, and clear to his boss, Albert Kesselring, that the resupply of the Africa Corps was becoming highly, highly problematic, because Britain had hung on in Malta and managed to reinforce it with aircraft that bombed shipping lanes, that chased off aircraft cover, fighter cover, and escorts for Italian and German ships, and made the resupply of North Africa more and more difficult. And this is crucial because Rommel's supply lines, because of his successes in North Africa, were becoming longer and longer. And in a way, it was the side in North Africa that managed to deal with this kind of elastic resupply problem, this a supply line problem that would ultimately win. And of course, the German Empire has reached the limits of what it's capable of in Russia too. So Germany, in its own way, experienced imperial overstretch by 1942-1943. Okay, so we're going to finish now in a moment. I'd just like to urge everybody, if you are looking to buy any Christmas presents, looking to buy any history book Christmas presents, you can get a 10% discount from Storytellers in St. Ives. They'll mail it all out to you. You know, you don't have to worry about that. If you follow the instructions in the notes to this podcast, it's a small independent bookshop, wonderful family-run little store, and it's worthy of supporting, just as any local bookshop is. If you can, support your local bookshops. Try not to buy from big online sellers, because they won't care when your local bookshop is boarded up and your high street is much the poorer for it. So give Storytellers an email, quote Explaining History, and you'll get 10% off your order. Thanks very much, and come and check us out at www.explaininghistory.org, and I'll catch you all soon. Take care, all the best, bye bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.